these goals. A journey into a world that is just beyond our comprehension. The world of the paranormal.
To the 13 Skulls. In this week's episode, we take a look at the Lost De Grazia paintings, a device for detecting ETs in your bedroom, a pterosaur is being blamed for sheep mutilations, a tree that sprays holy water, ancient chemical warfare, and Ripley's Believe It or Not is looking for you. So stay tuned for that and more in this 55th episode of the 13 Skulls. Welcome back, everybody. I really appreciate you coming out and taking a listen to the show. If you want more of the 13 Skulls goodness, you want more of the show, you enjoy listening to it, and you want to hear it more often, go to premium.the13skulls.com and sign up for the premium version of the show. You'll get one episode a week that's more or less an extended version of the show every single week for $5 a month. You can't beat that. I mean, you really can't. It's a lot of information, a lot of content, a lot of goodness for $5 a month. That's almost upwards of 8 hours of material for $5. You can't really beat that. You go to iTunes, you sign up, you pay 99 cents for one song that lasts for 3 or 4 minutes. Here you can sign up for $5 a month. That's about $1.25 a week, and you get almost 2 hours worth of content. It's a really good deal, and I'm going to promote it to you guys. If you want to sign up, it's a premium.the13skulls.com. And before we get started, I just had to say that my heart goes out to those in Japan that were affected by the earthquake and the tsunami. For those of you who are in the States or anywhere around the world that can't get a hold of the people that live there that you know, I really truly hope that they're all okay. And to those of you who are in Japan that would be listening to the show, I truly hope that you're all okay. And I hope that at least the death toll is kept at a very minimum. It was a massive earthquake, a big tsunami, and it just really it pains me to know that things like this happen, but I truly hope that those in Japan were okay. All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to the first thing that I wanted to take a look at today. It's about 8:30 in the morning on a Saturday, March 12th, I believe it is. And I got an email right before I started recording from Becky. And Becky says that, first, I wanted to say you're doing an amazing job with your show, and I always look forward to the new episodes. I have an experience that I'd like to share with you. Well, it's not one experience. It's a bunch of little things that make up one big thing. First of all, I live in Pennsylvania. This is an area very rich with history. It was this area that a hospital was stationed during the American Revolution. This being said, I must say some strange things happen in my house. I live with my mom, my grandfather, and our two dogs, Snoopy and Mickey. I have yet to see anything, but I'm sure that my dogs do on a regular basis. There are times when they'll be laying sleeping and they get up abruptly, run over to the steps, and look down to the basement. Sometimes they growl or whine, but usually they wag their tails. We don't know who or what they're seeing, but we think they are definitely seeing something that still to this day gives me the creeps. It was around Christmas time and I was getting ready to go to bed. I walked out of my room and my dog Mickey caught my eye. He was laying on my grandfather's bed and was staring off into the corner where the closet is. I called him and he didn't respond. I called him again and he looked at me. In his eyes, I saw fear. I said, "What's wrong, Mickey?" He just looked at me and looked back at the closet. What he did next really scared me. He started to follow something in the room as if something was pacing back and forth. His head went to the left, then to the right, and back to the left. Chills ran down my back and I made him go outside to the bathroom because he was really scaring me. The rest of the night was uneventful. The following night, my grandfather told me that he saw a shadow standing at his door. He thought it was my grandmother. She died in the house a few years ago. And he said to her, "It's okay, Joanne. You can look at the Christmas tree." The shadow stepped out of the hallway and looked down the hall at the tree and disappeared. He hasn't mentioned anything to me since, but to this day, it gives me chills. Thanks for reading my email, and I look forward to the next show. Thanks for all the hard work, Becky. Well, thank you very much, Becky. I really appreciate that. And as I was reading that, I was getting goosebumps myself. I have dogs. I have cats. Well, sadly, one of my cats passed away this week. You know, it was really a sad thing. She had the feline version of breast cancer, and it really drug out for a while. We did as much as we could to save her. She was a really strong cat, and, you know, I just wanted to say, rest in peace, Butterbean. You will be missed. But to get back on track, Becky, I really appreciate you writing in. I love hearing people's experiences like this, especially whenever it involves animals, because I've heard a lot of people say that animals can see and hear and sense more than any human can. You know, just for a quick example, their nose is like 200 times more powerful than a human's nose. Am I right with those, you know, 200 times? I'm not sure. I know some dogs' noses are a lot more sensitive than others. But my animals, I see them all the time looking at different things. I see my cat following things, and I don't really know what's going on with that. But it's really interesting that your dogs would see something. Were they seeing your grandmother? Were they seeing something maybe from the Revolutionary War? But it's really interesting that your grandfather saw a shadow figure. I've heard a lot of people say that shadow figures are a negative thing. Maybe it's just the way that they're able to appear. It's the only way that they can do it. I would think that you should be, you know, perfectly fine with what's going on, you know, and live with it, because if it's not really hurting you, then where is it really interfering with your life other than making you scared? And to be honest with you, you shouldn't be scared of this. This isn't something that should frighten you. Granted, yeah, it should make you a little apprehensive. You might get a little bit anxious about it. You might get goosebumps. Maybe I'm just blabbering on here. I just know that it was a great experience. I really appreciate you telling me this, Becky. Anything to do with animals, I'm going to love. Because animals don't lie. There's one thing that you can believe in this world, and is that an animal is going to tell you its true emotions. Now, granted, it can't speak to you, but you're going to see the true nature of that animal all the time. They're not going to lie to you. Now, I've had a dog that chewed up some things that maybe seemed like he was trying to lie about it, but anyway, that's beyond the point. Thank you very much, Becky, for sending that in. I really, truly do appreciate you sharing that. If anybody else out there wants to send in an email and let me know what kind of experiences you're having, something that might have happened to somebody in your family. I'd love to hear it. It's an amazing thing whenever you can hear someone go through the same experiences that you yourself have been through. You know, I really appreciate it. Don't mean to drag it on, but Becky, thank you very much. All right, well, I got another email just the other night from a local guy here named Tim, who is part of the Tastes Like Burning show. Tim and James are just really, really nice guys, but they live really close to me. And he sent me an email saying that they saw something on the news the other day. It was a motorcycle. It was a runaway motorcycle going about 100 miles an hour down the highway without a rider. How this happened, I don't know, but he says he saw the police helicopters flying around, but the weird thing is that they didn't have their searchlights on. All they had was just one super bright red light and green lights, more than I've seen on any other helicopter. The story is below. You can find it almost on any of the local news websites. A runaway motorcycle without a rider closes down Interstate 20 on March the 10th. In a strange turn of events, a runaway motorcycle without a rider closed down eastbound I-20 in Arlington as police searched for the rider of the bike. Numerous calls were placed to 911 by drivers reporting a motorcycle traveling past them at speeds of at least 100 miles an hour between Matlock Road and New York Avenue. Police took the initiative to close down the interstate in an attempt to search for the rider of the motorcycle. As of 10 o'clock on March the 10th, and as far as I know, as of right now, the police have yet to locate the rider, but they did find a watch, a visor, and a helmet. Law enforcement also knows the name of the owner of the bike, but have not yet determined if the owner has been with the motorcycle. So they're not sure if it was stolen. They're not sure what happened with it. But I know that from what I saw last night, I haven't really watched the news this morning, but from what I saw last night, they still have yet to find the driver. They do know who owns it, but they don't know who it was that was driving it. So was this some kind of ghost rider? Was this some kind of runaway motorcycle that was in control by something we don't know? Was this just a case of the guy wrecked the motorcycle, knew he was going to get in trouble, ditched the helmet and watch and visor and just ran off because he stole the bike? Nobody's going to know who he is. And if he had gloves on and stuff, nobody's going to see his face if he had the helmet on, and nobody's going to know any fingerprints if they can't find the gloves. Anyway, I just thought it was an interesting account of a possible ghost rider. And thank you very much, Tim. I really do appreciate you forwarding that on to me. If any of you guys out there hear of anything interesting, anything strange, anything odd, anything you think would go into the show, send it my way. I would love to. Just email me at 13skulls@gmail.com and I'll put it into the show. But I got a call in the other day from Mr. Lobo, and I wanted to take a listen to that right now.
DJ, it's Lobo. Just wanted to call in and tell you that I'm really enjoying the shows. I think it's awesome. The premium content is unbelievable. I've subscribed to other podcasts, premium content, and in my opinion, yours is by far well worth the meager amount that you're asking for in return for the amount of work you do. Just thought I'd call and give you support. Unfortunately, this time that I'm calling, it's something paranormal. But trust me, we've spoken before, and I have plenty in the bank to call up about. So I'll call it back and leave a message at a later date with some more information. I'm dealing with my own form of paranormal here. Three little girls drive me crazy. It can't be normal. So, brother, take it easy, man. Love the work. Love the podcast. Peace out.
Well, thank you very much, Lobo. And man, I tell you what, you're lucky to have three little girls, man. You really are. Dude, you got your hands full with three little girls. You know, I'm glad you're really liking the premium show. I've got nothing but good feedback from people. I really appreciate those of you who have subscribed to it. You really make me feel as if what I'm doing here is well worth it. Now, I'm far from being able to do this for a living, but, you know, it is something that I've enjoyed doing so far and will hopefully be able to continue to enjoy doing for a long time. And I really hope that you guys as well continue to enjoy it just as much. You know, Loba, don't worry about it, man. You know, if you ever feel like calling in again, please do. I really, you know, I want to hear you guys. I want to hear your experiences, what you've been through, your opinions. I want to hear what you think of the show, how you think it's going, what you want to hear in the show, anything. It doesn't really matter. You can get all the information when we do the formalities at the end of the show to be able to contact the show. Thank you again, Lobo. I really do appreciate it. Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Becky. Well, let's go ahead and move on to the first article of the day, which is courtesy of news.yahoo.com. Scientists are digging for Ice Age fossils in Los Angeles. With a dental pick in hand, Karen Rice delicately scraped off a clump of asphalt from a pelvic bone belonging to a horse that roamed Los Angeles tens of thousands of years ago. Like many unsuspecting creatures of the last ice age, the horse probably stopped to take a sip of spring water only to be ensnared and later preserved in a pool of sticky asphalt that seeped from underground crude oil deposits. For the past 3 years, scientists have been sifting through a significant trove of bones and nearly intact mammoth skeletons discovered in 2006 during the construction of an underground garage next to the tar pits, and those are the La Brea tar pits. So far, scientists have unearthed 5 of the 23 boxed deposits, removing some 16,000 fossilized bones. Among the finds, partial skulls and lower jaws of a half a dozen saber-toothed kittens, several ribs and a skull of a camel, and assorted remains of a giant jaguar, ground sloth, and baby mammoths. While visitors are wowed by the larger fossils, scientists are equally intrigued and interested in finding bits of insects, rodents, and microscopic organisms that can reveal a great deal about the past environment, said Page Museum Chief Curator John Harris. Harris estimated it will take 5 years to sort through the crates. The museum has placed a priority on getting the above-ground excavation done, so it temporarily halted work on Pit 91, where scientists have been pulling out bones since 1969. The tar pits, located 7 miles west of downtown Los Angeles, are a paleontological gold mine. Asphalt bubbled upward through the cracks and fissures over the millennia, trapping Ice Age beasts that later starved to death. Before the latest dig, more than 1 million bones had been recovered from the sticky ponds. Once the fossils are extracted, a process that can take months, they are shipped to the museum lab where they are cleaned, identified, and in some cases put on display. The current project is expected to double the museum's Ice Age collection. I just thought it was really interesting. I love archaeology. Again, as you all know, I've said it in almost every single episode. I love archaeology, and I really have always wanted to go to Los Angeles to visit the tar pits, just because it's something that you don't really see everywhere. It's a very odd thing all the way around. I mean, it's a tar pit that animals are getting stuck in. What I would give to have a camera and go back in time and see how it is that these animals got there. They said that they have pulled out millions of bones since 1969. That's got to be thousands upon thousands upon thousands of animals that have fallen in to just one single pit. And to be honest with you, I need to look up a little bit more. And I didn't because I had a weird week this week. I didn't look up to see how many tar pits there are around the world, but that is something that I've got in my mind that I want to take a look at later on. Let's go ahead and move on to another. I don't even know what to make of this. It's basically a treasure in the Superstition Mountains. It's courtesy of okietreasurehunter.blogspot.com. There is a treasure in the Superstition Mountains of Arizona known for the gold and silver, along with legends of the Lost Dutchman Mine and the Peralta Stones. But there are millions of dollars of artwork supposedly in these mountains. There was a famous painter by the name of Ettore Ted DeGrazia that, besides being famous for his artwork, was also well known for his protest against the IRS and its inheritance tax. In 1976, Mr. DeGrazia took more than 100 of his paintings out to the Superstition Mountains, close to Angel Springs, and with witnesses set them on fire and let them burn to ashes because he didn't want his kids to have to pay inheritance tax on the paintings. It seems the good folks at the IRS were saying his paintings were worth millions, and therefore his children would have to pay tax on them when he died. Even though he burned more than 100 paintings in the mountains, he also did hide a few of them as well. During a separate trip into the Superstition Mountains, Mr. DeGrazia and his friend Bob Ward buried 18 paintings. Each painting was rolled and placed in a watertight tube with both ends sealed, and then they bundled the tubes into groups of three. After that, they buried the groups of tubes in six separate spots, all within the same area. A pact was made between Mr. DeGrazia and Bob Ward, which required Bob to draw a map to the paintings, but not retrieve the paintings himself. Mr. DeGrazia instructed his friend to draw the map, keeping it until DeGrazia's death, and then sell the map to DeGrazia's wife so she could, in turn, sell copies of the map to anyone wanting to search for the paintings. Mr. DeGrazia felt that if his wife was the only one selling the map, then more people would believe that he really did bury the paintings. Mr. DeGrazia died in 1982, and his wife never got a copy of the map. Mr. Ward states that she was in ill health at the time and died before he could get the map to her. Mr. Ward held on to the coded map until 1990, when he decided to release it to the public. Through the years, there have also been rumors saying that while burning the paintings near Angel Springs, Mr. DeGrazia also hid a few more paintings in the same area. There haven't been any maps found that lead to the alleged second stash of paintings. As far as anyone can tell, no missing pieces of artwork have ever turned up. That's about as much to this article that is there. Actually, there's more there to it. You can go and take a look. There's all kinds of different treasure stuff that you can go and take a look at, and there is a copy of the map here. So if you wanted to take the map and make a copy of it and maybe go and search for these paintings, you could find millions and millions of dollars. I mean, if each painting is worth millions of dollars and there's 18 of them there, you could be quite well off if you could find these paintings. Anyway, go take a look at it and let me know what you think about the lost DeGrazia paintings. All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to forward on to you guys and just let you guys know what's going on here is from Wondertonic.com. Google Street View Zombie Apocalypse Running from the Living Dead in Your Own Neighborhood. What this is, Google Street View mixed with the zombie apocalypse. It's slightly cheesy, but it's a simple little game that you can go and play, and you can do it in your own neighborhood and basically get chased by zombies down your own street. I tried it out. It is kind of cheesy. All you have to do is enter in your address. It goes to Google Street View. It automatically places in the zombies and shows you on the map where they're at, and they come towards you and try to get you. It's just an interestingly fun little zombie apocalypse game that uses Google Street View. I thought it was kind of funny. I thought it was interesting. Let's go ahead and move on to the next thing that I wanted to take a look at. It's courtesy of OddityCentral.com. Again, I got to say thank you to Rojan for bringing in this website to me. I haven't ever heard of Oddity Central. Really quite a great website. They've got a lot of really cool stuff on there. But this particular thing caught my eye. A Japanese scientist has created what is being called the creepiest mobile phone ever. A group of scientists in Japan have created a doll-like mobile phone they say is designed to make you feel closer to the person you're talking to. Japan has been at the forefront of technological research and development for a long time. Some of the things they're coming up with over the years were incredibly weird and creepy. Case in point is the latest mobile phone prototype designed by researcher Takashi Minato. Assisted by a team of scientists, he has created a human-shaped cell phone with a skin-like outer layer that is supposed to help people feel closer to the person they're talking to. The current prototype is slightly larger than the palm of a hand and designed to look like a human and has a soft outer layer that heats and cools in a similar way to human skin. It's called into the creepy humanoid head of the handheld gadget, and the microphone is located at the bottom, where the feet should be. It also has a light-emitting diode that turns blue when the phone is in use and red when it's in standby mode. Minato and his colleagues hope to add image and voice recognition in the near future. Absolutely one of the most creepy things that I have ever seen. It doesn't have any legs. The legs go down to a V point where there's a hole down at the bottom where the feet should be. But it's in this odd T shape. It's like a human being standing there with their arms stretched out. Creepy. I want you guys to go and take a look at it and let me know what you think of the Japanese humanoid creepy mobile phone. You gotta love the Japanese. They're always coming up with something new. All right, guys, you know what? Let's go ahead and take a little bit of a break here. When we get back, we're going to be taking a look at a UFO detector that claims that it will alert you if ETs are in your bedroom. We're also going to be taking a look at quite a lot of really strange large cracks that have been opening up all over the world. We're also going to look at scientists who want to send signals into space, but warn we may get more than we bargained for. We're also going to take a look at a video of a UFO that was filmed in Devon. And for you premium people, we're going to be taking a look at the cockroach robot. A Swedish company is offering to freeze, then shatter your corpse. Charlie Sheen is facing a warlock curse, and two sons have been filmed in Bangkok. So you guys just stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute.
Eerie Radio, opening the door to the unknown. Download episodes of Eerie Radio directly from iTunes or visit their website at www.eerieradio.com.
What if the world suddenly wasn't what it seemed to be? For all the latest news from beyond the mainstream, tune into the Mysterious Universe podcast. Visit mysteriousuniverse.org for details.
Level of the mysterious radiation continues to increase steadily. So long as this situation remains, government spokesmen warn that dead bodies will continue to be transformed into the flesh-eating ghouls. All persons who die during this crisis, from whatever cause, will come back to life to seek human victims unless their bodies are first disposed of by cremation.
Are you ready for the zombie apocalypse? Maybe you should check out the Zombie Research Society. Founded in 2007, the Zombie Research Society is dedicated to raising zombie awareness in the fields of science, survival, and culture. Become a member of ZRS and let your voice be heard. The life you save could be your own. Remember, what you don't know can eat you.
Log in to zombieresearch.org for more information.
Have you ever had trouble sleeping for the fear that you might be violated or kidnapped or even both by extraterrestrial visitors in the middle of the night? Well, it could happen, and it looks like a company called Images SI Incorporated have made another piece of equipment called a UFO detector to give you heads up if something strange is hovering over your house. The claim is that the UFO detector is designed to sense these disturbances and will signal their presence by flashing an LED and beeping, suitable for display on a desk, shelf, or bedroom dresser. It's actually being sold through Amazon for $149.95 and has been available since October 2001. Now, I haven't actually seen this until now. You know, there's a lot of reviews in here for it. This one right here that I'm talking about is courtesy of DatelineZero.com. There is a link here that I will provide to you to Amazon for the UFO-01 detector. The size is approximately 3 inches in diameter by about 2.75 inches long. It uses a 9-volt lithium battery. It's really good. There's a lot of reviews here. There's a few bad reviews. There's a few good reviews. It's just an interesting little piece that you can go and take a look at. All you can really see on it is this cylindrical clear plastic case, I guess. I'm not sure exactly what it's made of. But it basically has a circuit board on the inside, a few wires, and a 9-volt battery. And it sits there, just like, you know, has a little stand on it that it will sit there, but it will let you know if aliens are inside your house or if there's a UFO hovering above your house with the possibility of being abducted by aliens. It will let you know if they're there. Whether or not it works, I don't know. I haven't actually purchased one. I believe the price to be just a little bit high. But you can go to Amazon and check them out. I'll post a link up to it. If you have any problems with UFOs, aliens visiting your house, you might want to invest in one of these. But the price tag of $149.95 is a bit steep. I might pay $20-25 for something like this. If you really do have a problem with it, you've had aliens in your room, you've had some kind of experiences with missing time, or you think you've been abducted, this could be a good piece of equipment just to let you know that they're there. You know, whether or not it is a truly functioning item, I don't know. But if you have purchased one of these and you've used it, let me know. I'd love to hear what your experience with it was. But I just wanted to pass that on to you guys. I thought it was just an interestingly odd piece of equipment. The next thing that I wanted to take a look at is an exhibit on thoughtographs. If you're looking for signs of paranormal activity, look no further than Gainesville. That's where an unusual photography exhibit at UMBC's Kuhn Library Gallery prompts you to wonder whether reality is more than a simple black and white affair. Psychic projections slash photographic impressions concerns a scientific study conducted during the 1960s. A Chicago bellhop, Ted Serios, who lived from 1918 to 2006, claimed he was able to use psychic energy in order to directly place his mental images onto Polaroid film. A Denver psychiatrist, Dr. Jules Eisenbud, who lived till 1999, undertook experiments to test the claim. Studying several hundred photographs that he called thoughtographs, Eisenbud became convinced that Serios truly had paranormal powers. Although the UMBC exhibit strenuously remains neutral in the matter, the exhibited photos sure do make you wonder what produced them. And they are quite odd pictures there that you can go and take a look at. One of them is what is supposedly a picture of a double-decker bus that has this weird, slightly focused yet slightly out of focus, almost a moving image, you know, like you take a picture of something that's moving and it's smeared, but it's only on part of the photograph. Supposedly, this is one of the ones that he did. It says that the ghostly glimpse of a double-decker bus is among the images captured on Polaroid film by Ted Serios using his psychic powers. It's included in the gallery, and for anybody who's actually near Cantonsville, if you go and see this, let me know. I'd love to see this exhibit. I don't think it's a traveling exhibit. I think it's just an exhibit that's in one place that you can go and see. Thoughtographs are really an odd thing. I've heard of people taking a brand new, unopened pack of Polaroid film, thinking of a word, and, you know, doing whatever it is that they do, and when they take a picture, whatever it is that they take a picture of has that word written on the film. It's a very odd thing. I want to look more into it to see if I can find, you know, what's going on with this. I don't know much about it. There's a whole bunch of stuff out there that you can look into, but there's so much that I haven't been able to read up on at all. So whenever I do, I will let you guys know. There's a lot more to this article there if you wanted to go and take a look at it. We've just got so much stuff out there that I can't just stop right here. We're already going well into the show, and I'm barely touching anything that I wanted to look at today. There's just a ton of stuff. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article. Actually, that last one was courtesy of explorehoward.com. Again, I will post links up to all of this stuff in the show notes so you can go and read up more on it for yourself. The next thing that I wanted to take a look at was something that's very odd to me. It's courtesy of dailygalaxy.com. A new African ocean in Ethiopia is emerging with spectacular speed. In 2005, an Ethiopian volcano erupted, tearing a 35-mile rift in the country in a matter of days, which is incredibly fast in geological terms, especially since this may well be the first sign of an incoming Ethiopian ocean. Scientists from several countries have confirmed that the volcanic process at work beneath the Ethiopian rift are nearly identical to those at the bottom of the world's oceans, and the rift is indeed likely the beginning of a new sea. This work is a breakthrough in our understanding of continental rifting, leading to the creation of new ocean basins, says Ken McDonald, professor emeritus in the Department of Earth Science at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and who is not affiliated with the research. The whole point of the study is to learn whether what is happening in Ethiopia is like what is happening at the bottom of the ocean, where it's almost impossible for us to go, says Cynthia Ebinger, professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester and co-author of the study. We knew that if we could establish that, then Ethiopia would essentially become a new, unique, and superb ocean ridge laboratory for us. Because of the unprecedented cross-border collaboration behind the research, we now know that the answer is yes, it is analogous. The spectacular speed is what stunned scientists. It was assumed that such events occurred slowly in smaller steps, not sudden tectonic upheavals of the kind that cut the Earth itself open in less than a week. This raises important questions, both in terms of geophysical processes which shape the Earth we live on, and for anyone living within an earthquake of such a region. Even with earthquake acceleration, it'll be a long time before the Ethiopian port becomes an issue. But this sudden starting point will be an international hub of oceanographic interest until then. And with oceanographers carefully studying the African desert, it's proof that nature has a sense of irony. Very true. You're in the African desert and you're studying oceanography. I wonder if this really is going to be the beginning of a new ocean and how long it's going to take for the new or a new sea, how long it would take for that amount of water, which would constitute a sea or ocean, how long it would take for that water to fill in this place. You can go and take a look at the rift that's being caused here, and for it to be caused in about a week is just, it's just crazy. Now, is this more of what's going to be causing a sea or new ocean, or is this just like a different case of plate tectonics, continental rifting, where the ground gets ripped apart? It's just really interesting. I want you guys to go and take a look at it. There's more to that article there that you can go and take a look at, and it shows you a few pictures of the breaks in the ground itself. Now, the next thing that I wanted to point you guys in the direction of is something that is called RoboEarth.org. At its core belief, RoboEarth is a worldwide web for robots, a giant network and database repository where robots can share information and then learn from each other about their behavior and their environment, bringing a new meaning to the phrase, experience is the best teacher. The goal of RoboEarth is to allow robotic systems to benefit from the experience of other robots, paving the way for rapid advances in machine cognition and behavior, and ultimately for subtle and sophisticated human-machine interaction. RoboEarth will include everything needed to close the loop from robot to RoboEarth to robot. The RoboEarth World Wide Web-style database will be implemented on a server with internet and intranet functionality. It stores information required for object recognition, navigation, tasks, and host intelligence services. To close the loop, RoboEarth collaborators will also implement components for a ROS-compatible, robot-unspecific, high-level operating system, as well as components for robot-specific, low-level controllers accessible via a hardware abstraction layer. More or less, it's just going to be kind of like a social networking system for robots. There's a lot here that you can go and take a look at. You can go and see what RoboEarth is, the motivation, the project scope, workshops and events, media, industrial advisory committees, how they get their funding. You can contact them. You can look at the private section. You can actually become a member of this to log in to see some of the more private stuff. I just wonder how they're going to build robots that are actually going to be able to understand and learn from this. Now, I'm not saying that robots can't learn. I'm not saying that technology can't learn, but it's just, it's a weird thing because this means that robots and technology is getting smarter and smarter and a little bit more self-aware. The next thing that I wanted to take a look at, there's actually two websites for it. One of them is Wikipedia and the other one is sprki.com. A man has spent 30 years recreating a model of Herod's temple. Now, Herod's temple is in Jerusalem. It was a massive expansion of the Temple Mount platform and major expansion of the Jewish temple by King Herod the Great around 19 BCE. Now, recently there has been a UFO sighting, or at least what was said to be a UFO sighting, at Temple Mount. You can actually go and see the remaining wall from Herod's temple. There's a picture of it there. It's just a really, really cool place. I really want to visit it. It's really, it's a fascinating thing. But this man has completely recreated the entire temple from scratch. It's a miniaturized version. Alec Gerard, who's 78, is the guy who did it. He's a retired farmer who has spent more than 30 years building an enormous scale model of the temple. He dedicated a massive 33,000 hours to construct the ancient temple, which measures a whopping 20 feet by 12 feet. He hand-baked and painted every clay brick, tile, and even sculpted 4,000 tiny human figures to populate the courtyards. He spent more than 3 years researching the temple, which was destroyed by Romans 2,000 years ago and deemed to be one of the most remarkable buildings of ancient times. He started this epic project in his 40s and says his masterpiece will not be finished in his lifetime. Man, and if he hand-carved all these, I mean, the little models of the people are not all that great, but the model itself is pretty fascinating. Now, some of the models you'll see are really good, rather well done. But the model itself as a whole is really quite amazing. The man did a fantastic job, especially considering that the humans that he carved out are really no more than maybe 3/4 of an inch long and maybe at most 1/4 of an inch wide. And he built almost 4,000 of them. He's got little pens with animals in it, little courtyards. There's, a little guy climbing up a ladder to light a candle. You know, it's just really fascinating. And for those of you who like biblical history or just history in general, go and take a look at this. It's really, really fascinating. And it's really big, too. And I can see why it would have taken this long, especially if he hand-carved, hand-baked, and hand-painted every single piece in this. Some of the parts of this are really quite a bit better than others. There's one picture of it, what's inside this building of a long hallway. It's very, very well done. I want you guys to go and take a look at this and let me know what you think. I'll provide a link up to the website with all the pictures of it, and I'll provide a link up to the Wikipedia article that explains more about Herod's temple. All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to take a look at is something courtesy of edition.cnn.com. There's a video there to it. I tried to download it so I could get the audio to put it in the show, but I just couldn't. For some reason, I couldn't find the right service that it was using. But apparently, these people are going on a road trip around the world to warn people of the end of the world. Sheila Jonas is one of the people that's going to do that. If you thought that you had less than 3 perfectly healthy months to live, what would you do? Would you travel? Spend time with loved ones? Appreciate the joy life has given you? Or would you ditch your kids and grandkids, join strangers in a caravan of RVs, and travel around the country warning people about the end of the world? That's exactly what Sheila Jonas is doing. "This is so curious, I can't believe I'm here," she says, who's been on the road since fall. Like her cohorts, she's in it till the end, and believes that it's coming this May. She won't talk about her past because there's no other story. The people that are doing this are wearing sweatshirts and clothing announcing the awesome news that Judgment Day is going to come on May 21st. On that day, people who will be saved will be raptured up to heaven. The rest will endure exactly 153 days of death and horror before the end of the world on October 21st. That message is splashed across their 5 sleek vinyl-wrapped RVs bearing the promise, "The Bible guarantees it." The 5 vehicles in this caravan are numbered 11 through 15, and the ambassadors line them up in numerical order before hitting the road. They say that they have been chosen by God to spread the news that few understand. They liken themselves to biblical figures, including Jonah, who God commanded to warn people of Nineveh of their city's destruction. They say their work comes with ample precedence, that the God they believe in would never bring judgment on his people without warning them first. Their job is to sound the alarm, pointing to Ezekiel 33. Just by being out in their RVs, wearing their t-shirts, they say they are fulfilling a mission. They say that dead bodies are going to be laying everywhere up until October 21st, when everyone goes for judgment. Now, there is a lot more of this article here. I mean, way more. It would take me literally another hour to read through all this, just because there is so much there. And there's a video there that you can go and take a look at that's literally just a few minutes long, but it gives you a little bit more of an understanding of what they're doing, and it kind of explains it in their own words as to exactly what's going to happen. Do you think that the end of the world is going to happen this year? I mean, people say it's going to happen this year. People say it's going to happen in 2012. Some people are saying it's going to happen in 2013. I've heard people say that it's going to happen in 2036 when an asteroid comes and hits the Earth. I would think that if God was to be warning us of the end of the world, that it would come in ways different from driving around in a caravan telling people this. There have always been people out there that are saying that the end is nigh. The end is nigh. It's going to happen soon. Well, it never really did. So, you know, I have my issues with this kind of story. Just because of that. I have my issues because of people being blasphemers, people not really knowing what's going to happen. But at the same time, maybe they're telling the truth. Maybe they have been warned. Maybe they are going out there and telling everybody what's going to happen. But I don't know. I guess we'll just have to see what happens. If we're all here on October 22nd, then we know that what they were saying wasn't true. If we're not, then I guess they were speaking the truth. Either way, let me know what you think about this. At least go watch the video. It's rather interesting. All right, guys, so you know what? We're going to take a little bit of a break here. When we get back, we're going to be taking a look at what's being called a pterosaur attack on sheep. A large crater is found in South Peru, and a man in a Bigfoot suit is suing New Hampshire. That and much more. We'll be back in just a few minutes, so stay tuned. Thing I wanted to take a look at is courtesy of naturalplane.blogspot.com. Sheep mutilations are being blamed on a giant bird or pterosaur. Lawn out there at Phantoms and Monsters says the livestock owner explains that there are some very large talon marks but very little blood and no evisceration. Was it an attack by a large flying predator? Were the carcasses left intact for a reason, and could this have been a chupacabra? The man who contacted Lon, J.C., mentioned that a large cryptid bird or pterosaur may have been responsible for the act. For many generations, people in New Mexico and parts of Texas say they have seen birds so big that they seem prehistoric. One man claims the rugged landscape near Las Cruces hides a mystery that's haunted him for several years. Dave Zander has lived near the Doña Ana Mountains for more than 30 years, spending almost all of his spare time hiking and exploring and fossil hunting in the range between the Robledo and Oregon Mountains. He saw something that he's unable to explain and many people find hard to believe. He recalls the day 11 years ago when he spotted something extraordinary, two creatures perched on a mountain less than a mile away. These creatures were so huge, they looked like the size of a small plane. All of a sudden, one of them jumped off, dropped off the top of the mountain, came down the front of the mountain, and all of a sudden, these two huge wings just spread out. I would say the wings were at least a 20-foot wingspan. He said it was not a normal bird, and definitely a giant variety of some kind. Now, one ancient bird in the vicinity is an Andean condor living at the Rio Grande Zoo in Albuquerque. But its wingspan of 12 feet pales to what Zander described. Birds with an unprecedented 20-foot wingspan, with pink bald heads and all black bodies and feathers on their enormous wings. It's really quite a crazy thing, but they're saying that this thing is responsible for the killing of these sheep. And you can go and see where there's probably 6 or 7 of these sheep laying around that are just dead, and that they have these huge gash marks on them that they're saying are from talons. What is it? Is it a condor? Is it an escaped condor? Condor with a 12-foot wingspan is really quite large, and from a distance might look bigger than what it really is. Is that the case for this? I don't know. There is a lot more there to this article. Some pictures of a condor that has about a 12-foot wingspan. It's also got pictures of supposedly some Civil War soldiers next to a pterosaur, some older, older black and white pictures that are really quite fascinating. I want you guys to go and take a look at this and let me know what you think about the phantom bird that's killing sheep. All right, well, the next thing I wanted to do is hand the reins over to Rojan for a special St. Patrick's Day edition of Anomalous. Take it away, Rojan.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the St. Patty's Day edition of Anomalous. This episode is going to be a little bit longer than the usual Anomalous episode. I've found a lot of cool stuff. I've really been looking forward to doing it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to split it into two separate episodes. I'm going to give half of the content to the free subscribers. And then if you're a paid subscriber, you're going to get a little bit something extra in the premium edition of the 13 Skulls. So without further ado, let's just grab our green beer and jump right on in. TJ had stated way back when I used to send him gobloads of information and story content for his show, and I used to fill his email box up constantly with it, that I was really good at finding obscure information and different kinds of paranormal stories. And I took that to heart, and that's what I wanted to put into Anomalous when I decided to make the show, was to be able to provide you people with information that you're not normally going to hear about on other paranormal shows, really obscure stuff. But I would be really remiss if I were to do a St. Patrick's Day show without covering leprechauns. Almost all of the information from tonight's show, with a few exceptions here and there from Wikipedia, of course, comes from a website called www.irelandseye.com.
You know you don't have to be part of this plan.
Yeah, but I'm the only one that looks normal enough to go into town and buy us food. Isn't that right?
Normal? You're not even Irish!
Look, I told you when we met that I was not a leprechaun, that I was from Rhode Island, and that I was half Korean, and you said it didn't matter.
You're both yo-yos. Shut up, you yo-yos.
There are many different possible origins for the leprechaun in the Irish realm of fairies, sprites, and goblins, among many others. Patrick S. Deneen, an Irish historian, defined the leprechaun as being a pygmy or a sprite. He also defines him as a kind of aqueous spirit. The word leprechaun also means small or half-bodied, according to the Collins English Dictionary. One of the speculative origins of the word is Leith Borgan, as quoted from the Oxford English Dictionary as meaning shoemaker. The leprechaun is often called the fairy shoemaker in Ireland. In traditional portraits and images of the leprechaun, he is often shown as holding or working on a little shoe. Some speculate instead that the word leprechaun instead derives from Luck Cromann, which means little stomping luck. Luck is the leader of the Talfa de Danann, or people of the goddess of Danu, a race of creatures of an Irish mythology, which were part at one point of a race of human beings and have slowly been immortalized by their legends. Luck was the High King, and has deities that reflect his character in other cultures and systems of mythology, such as Celtic and Welsh. The first time the word leprechaun appeared in text, it was in the early 17th century, and was instead called Leprechaun in Middleton and Dexter's The Honest Whore. It appeared, though, as more of a spirit, and not exactly the mythological character. They don't often have a mythology surrounding them like other deities, and instead are often told of conversationally, like any other occurrence. They are in stories, but not as the actual subject of the story. For example, a leprechaun might be the aid to the hero, but is usually not the hero himself. Leprechauns have also become the self-appointed guardians of ancient treasure left by the Danes when they marauded through Ireland, burying it in crocks and pots. This may be one reason why leprechauns tend to avoid contact with humans who they regard as foolish, flighty, and greedy creatures. If caught by a mortal, he will promise great wealth if allowed to go free. He carries two leather pouches. In one there is a silver shilling, a magical coin that returns to the purse each time it is paid out. In the other he carries a gold coin, which he uses to try to bribe his way out of difficult situations. This coin usually turns to leaves or ashes once the leprechaun has parted with it. However, you must never take your eye off of him or he can vanish in an instant.
Well, just in time for St. Patrick's Day, crowds are coming by the dozens to get an up-close view at what some say is a piece of Irish folklore.
Some people in the Crichton area of Mobile say a leprechaun has taken up residence in their neighborhood. A leprechaun. NBC 15's Brian Johnson has more.
Curiosity leads to large crowds in Mobile's Crichton community, many of you bringing binoculars, camcorders, even camera phones to take pictures.
To me, it looked like a leprechaun to me. All I gotta do is look up in the tree. Who else in the leprechaun say yeah?
Yeah!
Eyewitnesses say the leprechaun only comes out at night. If you shine a light in its direction, it suddenly disappears. This amateur sketch resembles what many of you say the leprechaun looks like. Others find it hard to believe and have come up with their own theories and explanations for the image.
My theory is it's casting a shadow from the other limb.
Could be a crackhead that got hold to the wrong stuff and it told him to get up in a tree and play a leprechaun.
We don't get down to the bottom of this. Yeah, still on there, guy. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, man.
This guy, helping to direct traffic, says he's prepared for his encounter with the leprechaun. He's suited up from head to toe.
This wars off spells right here. This is a special leprechaun flute, which has been passed down from thousands of years ago from my great-great-grandfather, who was Irish. I just came to help out.
Others just came to get lucky in hopes a pot of gold may be buried under this tree.
I'm going to run a backhoe and uproot that tree. I want to know where the gold is. I want the gold. Give me the gold. I want the gold.
This is Brian Johnson, NBC 15 News.
People will do anything for a pot of gold. I mean, anything.
You know what I like? I like the amateur sketch of the leprechaun.
Okay, here's one more short piece I'm going to do about leprechauns and their relation to St. Patrick, and then I'm going to move on to the leprechaun's evil cousin, which is the clerican. What does the leprechaun have to do with St. Patrick? Well, the leprechaun is actually one of the fairies of ancient Irish mythology. He was feared because he hid from human view, but he was also revered because of his riches, in the form of pot of gold. The leprechaun was later adopted by St. Patrick as a symbol of God. Like the leprechaun, Patrick noted that God remains hidden from view, is to be feared, and also has great riches for those who can find him. Because the Irish believed that the leprechaun used the rich green countryside to conceal himself, the color green became associated with him as well as all things that had to do with St. Patrick. Drinking of beer, green and otherwise, is definitely part of the rituals involved with this holiday. There is more beer consumed in Ireland on St. Patrick's Day than there is any other day of the year. This may well be because of St. Patrick's pagan-based practice of honoring Brigid with poteen, which is an Irish beer made from potatoes. Or it may just be that the Irish really know how to seriously throw down and party. St. Patrick, by the way, is also credited as bringing the art of distillery to Ireland. Well, there you have it. Leprechauns, green beer, and a little bit of pagan information about Mr. St. Patrick himself. Moving on, clerics. The clerican, or clobhair in O'Kearney, is an Irish fairy which resembles a leprechaun. Some folklorists describe the clerican as a knight form of a leprechaun, who goes out to drink after finishing his daily chores. Others regard them as the regional variations of the same creature. Clerics are said to always be drunk. However, unlike their cousins, they are surly. Many fables conclude clerics enjoy riding sheep and dogs at night. If you treat them well, they will protect your wine cellar. If mistreated, they will wreak havoc on your home and spoil your wine stock. In some tales, they act as buttery spirits, plaguing drunkards and dishonest servants who steal wine. If the victim attempts to move away from their tormentor, the clerican simply hops into a cask or any other random objects and accompanies them to wherever they move. So basically, they sit around getting drunk all night, they ride your sheep and your goats around, they torment you, and if you piss them off, then they ruin your wine. What a dick. Well, that's it for this edition of Anomalous. Please pop over to the premium edition, where I'll catch up with you there. We'll be talking more about Irish folklores and fairy tales. We'll be discussing the Banshee, the Grogach, and the Dullahan. That's it for this episode. Till next time, this is Rogan. Peace out from the D.
To me, it look like a leprechaun to me. All you gotta do is look up in the tree. Who else seen the leprechaun and say yeah?
Yeah! I would wanna know what to go. I would wanna know what to go.
Give me the go.
I would wanna know what to go. I would wanna know what to go.
Give me the go.
I would wanna know what to go. I would wanna know what to go.
Give me the go.
I would wanna know what to go. I would wanna know what to go.
Give me the go.
Well, thank you very much, man. I really do appreciate you sending that in. There will be quite a bit more to the St. Patrick's Day edition of Anomalous in the premium version of the show. It's really quite good. I suggest you guys go sign up if you already haven't. For those of you who have, I think you'll enjoy it quite a bit. And happy St. Patrick's Day to all of my Irish friends out there. I hope you're having a good time. Enjoy the day if you can. I know it's not today, but it's coming up soon. So enjoy the green beer, and let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of content.usatoday.com. Egypt's chief antiquities official, Zahi Hawass, has confirmed his resignation late this week from his post amid political turmoil and the looting of antiquities. Because of all the stuff that's going on in Egypt right now and all the stuff that has gone on over the past few weeks, it's not really all that surprising that he is handing over his job and not doing it anymore. Hawass is well known for his role in archaeological investigations and overseas exhibitions. Some controversy has swirled in the Western press over Hawass's resignation. First reported Thursday by the New York Times in a note emailed to USA Today on Saturday, Hawass confirmed his resignation from his recently named post heading Egypt's Antiquities Ministry. Hawass, who's 63, says, "I don't have concrete plans for the future yet. I'm still thinking about what I should do." There's a couple of different reasons there why he's saying he's resigning. During the earlier protest, Egyptian youths and the police protected the museums and the monuments. Only the Egyptian Museum in Cairo was broken into, and all the important objects inside were safe, and only a few things were lost and broken. Since the revolution, many people have continued to protest over things, such as against me, or Hawass, over jobs and salaries. It's not impossible to provide everything that everyone is asking for. Crooks in the ministry and at the University of Cairo have started to attack him personally, and he can't stand it. But most importantly is that there is not enough police to protect the sites. So in other words, there's not enough police to protect the sites, so he's just going to give up and go his own way. The Egyptian antiquities that are there on tour at the moment are safe and kept so with contracts. They are completely safe, and when the police are asked to back them up in force, everything here will be protected properly again, says Hawass. Those were the reasons why he said he was leaving. But to me, it almost seems like, you know, if nobody else cares, then neither do I. Screw it, I'm out. I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. I don't know. Either way, I just thought it was interesting that he's been such a figure in bringing all of the Egyptian antiquities to life, all of the history of Egypt to life. But yet he'll be one of the first ones to just up and leave when things get a little bit difficult. I don't know. But let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of Sot.net. The sudden appearance of an enormous crack in southern Peru, measuring 100 meters wide and 3 kilometers long, caused confusion among residents of the Huacalani district in the Chucuito province. Hopefully I'm not butchering that too bad. Let me know if I am. The exact cause of the crack in the earth is still unknown. Peru's Geophysical Institute ruled out the occurrence of an earthquake in the region, but what is clear is that the ground opened up and large blocks of earth can be observed scattered throughout the area. The event, recorded on Wednesday morning, caused the collapse of one house located in a rural community. Four people managed to escape, but the youngest member of the family, a 5-year-old, is missing. Geological engineers from the Regional Committee for Civil Defense have arrived in the area to investigate the phenomenon and to determine its causes, said Javier Papamalco, who's the civil defense chief. There's a video there that you can go and see this large 3-kilometer-long crack. There's a lot of things that are geologically happening over the world. I mean, we just had the earthquake in Japan. We just had this massive crack open up in Peru. And then there's one that opens up in Africa. This one's courtesy of NewScientist.com. And this goes back to the ocean in Africa that we were just talking about, which is another huge crack in the Earth's crust, which, again, could be the forerunner to a new ocean. It ripped open in just days in 2005. It's located in the Afar region of Ethiopia. The crack is the surface component of the continental rift, and the magma inside the volcano did not reach the surface and erupt as a fountain of lava. Instead, it was diverted into the continental rift underground. The magma cooled into a wedge-like dike that was then uplifted, rupturing the surface and creating a 500-meter-long and 60-meter-deep crack. A lot of people say that stuff like this is going on is just a precursor to what's going to happen in 2012. And what those people were talking about earlier is just a precursor to the rapture happening in May all the way through October of this year. Now, it is roughly going on the middle of March now, so we got a little over a month and a half left to see what's going to happen there. But either way, I just thought it was really, really interesting. Let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of zombieresearch.net. You might get trampled at Walmart if the zombie apocalypse does happen. ZRS researcher Mike Barnes recently completed an analysis of injuries occurring in large crowds over the last several years. His hypothesis being that if a base level of causation can be identified, then we can better anticipate human threats presented when the dead rise. Unfortunately, what Barnes found was not encouraging. From Boston to Beijing, people of all ages and walks of life actively participated in the deaths of their fellow man to accomplish their own trivial objectives. Innocent bystanders were trampled to death in Angola in March of 2009 so that a mob could get a better view of the visiting Pope. 1 month later in the Ivory Coast, 22 people were killed in a stampede of soccer fans upset about their team's loss. In 2006, 346 pilgrims were crushed to death in the last day of their trip to visit Mecca. And the list goes on. But perhaps the most telling example is that of a Walmart worker who was 270 pounds who died on November 28th of 2008 after being trampled by suburban Long Island shoppers looking to take advantage of early holiday discounts. Even the paramedics who unsuccessfully attempted to revive the man were jostled by the aggressive crowd. If everyday citizens are killing each other just to get a better price on a flat screen, imagine what ugly behaviors will surface when actual survival is at stake. Barnes' findings suggest that inadvertent human violence may well be a greater cause of death and destruction than any flesh-eating zombie in the coming undead pandemic. So good luck. Now, it really is interesting to know that people trample each other to death because they want to see something, they want to hear something, they want to buy something. Is it that people look at the situation like that and they can throw the blame on everyone else and not themselves, which really they're thinking of as being a selfless thing? It wasn't me, it was them. When in all honesty, it was you. You were part of that. If you weren't part of that, it wouldn't have happened, regardless of whether or not you were the one who stepped on the person and killed them or not. It's just crazy. I hope that the zombie apocalypse doesn't happen, but if it does, don't go to Walmart. Don't go to your grocery stores. Don't go anywhere like that, because all you're going to do is help with the hysteria and cause more problems. Now, the next thing that I wanted to take a look at is courtesy of WRAL.com, and a man in a Bigfoot suit is suing New Hampshire. A performance artist and amateur filmmaker who dressed as the Bigfoot says New Hampshire park rangers didn't have the right to kick him off a mountain where he had been scaring or at least amusing hikers while friends videotaped his antics. Backed by the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, Jonathan Doyle is suing the state, arguing that the requirement to pay $100 for a special use permit 30 days in advance and get a $2 million insurance bond violates his free speech rights. The underlying activities are humorous, but the principles important, said John Meyer, a lawyer representing Doyle. We're talking about a very small-scale activity in a very large place. We don't believe there's any legitimate government role in regulation. Doyle's attorney said no one complained to the State Park Service about Doyle first dressed as Bigfoot, ran around the rocky top of Mount Mondonok, returned to human form, and interviewed bystanders about what they saw. People loved it. It was socially engaging, Doyle said. When I showed up at the top of the mountain dressed as Bigfoot and beating my chest, everyone just laughed and hoorayed. Hikers describing their encounters in a video Doyle posted on YouTube seemed happy to get in on the fun and inflate the legend. Doyle said he thinks the officials found his Bigfoot stunt and the publicity it generated tacky for a mountain revered by literary giants Henry Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson. Both sides agreed there's no need for a trial because no facts are in dispute. What they dispute is whether the administrative rule requiring permits, as it was applied to Doyle, violates his First Amendment rights to free speech and expression. Very interesting indeed. I don't really understand why it is that they're making this guy do that, but, you know, there are rules and regulations in place to keep people from doing stupid things and not having to pay for it. But this is just fun. I mean, it really is just simply fun. And why they're making this guy do that, I don't know. Maybe they're trying to get some of the money this guy is going to be making off of this documentary that he's doing. I don't know. Either way, I don't think he should have to pay, or at least maybe not get the $2 million insurance bond. I mean, pay $100, you know, whatever, that's fine. You know, pay it, dude. Just pay it. And, you know, not have to get the $2 million insurance bond. That's what I think. Whatever, you know, to each of their own. Now, the next article that I wanted to take a look at is courtesy of naturalplane.blogspot.com. On September 14th of 1957, Ibrahim Soued, a columnist for the Rio de Janeiro newspaper O Globo, printed a letter which he had received concerning a UFO event. Accompanying the letter were three small pieces of white metal. The writer of the letter described an event in which a flying disc exploded over the beach of Ubatuba. Now, am I pronouncing that right, Ubatuba? It's U-B-A-T-U-B-A, in the Sao Paulo province. Some of the metal which had fallen from the exploding disc was collected, and three small pieces were included in the letter to Sued. Unfortunately, the signature on the letter was illegible, but furthermore, the identity of all witnesses to the original seaside event remains unknown. Despite extensive searches by the Brazilian representatives of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, or APRO, the lack of witnesses is one of the greatest weaknesses of the case. One of the original fragments, designated sample number 1 by Dr. Fontes, was subdivided into several pieces, and two pieces were submitted to the spectrographic section of the Mineral Production Laboratory Semi-Quantitative Emission Spectrochemical Analysis. One of the pieces was analyzed and surprisingly revealed that the sample contained only the element magnesium. A second fragment of sample number 1 was submitted to a separate spectrographic analysis and found that it was pure magnesium. Further tests were run on the fragments. These included Debye-Scherer-Hull powder pattern X-ray diffraction analysis, density measurement, and radiation tests. The interatomic spacing of the samples closely matched those cited for magnesium. But sadly, the two fragments were destroyed by their analytical procedure, and no further portions of sample number 1 were available for further verification of the original results. Now, there's quite a bit more there to it that you can go and read. I mean, there's really is quite a whole lot more there to it. But there are pictures of the metal themselves that you can go and take a look at to see what it was that these people found. Now, what is the significance of it being magnesium? I don't really know. I do know that magnesium to some degree can be explosive. Maybe there was some kind of a reaction with the atmosphere, heat, and the magnesium that caused this flying disc, quote-unquote, to explode over the beach in Ubatuba. You know what, guys? Let's take one last little break before we continue on with the rest of the show. When we get back, we're going to be taking a look at a time travel experiment that demonstrates how to avoid the grandfather paradox, and Ripley's Believe It or Not is looking for you. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute.
Many were infected. Infected with a disease that thinks, a disease that talks, and as the victims finally succumbed, a disease that walks. One man fought back. He resisted the voices. Perry Dawsey carved out pieces of himself in a desperate attempt to survive. He won. But as Perry awakes in a government hospital, he realizes he can still hear those voices. It's not over. And now it's even worse, because the infection has become contagious. Contagious is the bloody sequel to Scott Sigler's horror thriller, Infected. Contagious is available in stores December 30th. Or reserve your copy now at scottsigler.com/pre-order. Get the book the day it comes out, because if someone spoils the ending, you'll hate yourself enough to use the chicken scissors.
So, you thought that Hall of Mirrors Volume 1 was the end of the hall, did you? Well, think again, listener. Hall of Mirrors Volume 2. A further 6 tales of horror, the grotesque, and people in unusual circumstances. In Salvation, Jeffrey Leach makes a pact with Satan, but when the time to make good on the deal arrives, will Jeffrey be able to give the devil his due? In Give Me 100, small-time crook Benny is late for a hold-up. However, bad timekeeping is just the start of his problems. In The Green Man, Alec and Libby find there are darker things in the woods than Alec's not-so-lovely picnic spot. In dessert, a man takes his dog for a walk and neglects to bring a little baggie for its poop. Nightmarish? Oh, yes. In The Exterminators, we journey to New York to discover a new and extremely cunning species of predatory cockroach. And finally, in Night Crossing, we meet Lord Underwood and his trusty sidekick, Flinch, in the short story prequel to the novel Underwood and Flinch. And a most bloody introduction it is, too. Hall of Mirrors, Volume 2 by Mike Bennett. Tales of murder, horror, pest infestation, and dog poo baggy dilemmas. Available for download now at podiobooks.com.
Immortality, longevity, an endless lifespan. Watching civilizations rise and fall. What would you do to become immortal?
My name is McAllen Orsel. I'm a genetic scientist in New York. I'm caught in a secret war between two powerful groups of immortals. I've been told that I am a messiah to a group of people I barely know. I'm forced on a quest around the globe to fulfill a destiny I never chose. If only I can stay alive.
From Krzysztof Lipútka comes The Leviathan Chronicles, an audio adventure like you've never heard before.
What is Leviathan?
I'll tell you as much as I know.
We have been among you for almost a millennium.
What? Immortal?
But I can't know about Leviathan.
Dive!
We're hitting crushed depth.
Blow those charges.
No!
I do!
Nothing this big has ever moved that fast underwater.
I have no tolerance for your lack of commitment.
Why have you brought me here?
You are here because we need your help. The man you met earlier was named Whit Roberts.
I believe her condition is the result of an attack.
He's a liar and an assassin.
You are going to tell me what I want to know.
She was never trained for this.
She was bred for it, Anton.
Well, she doesn't know that.
The only question is...
You'll need to find the key, McAllen.
How much damage are we going to do in the meantime?
To discover the Leviathan Chronicles and get the next dimension in podcasting, go to www.leviathanchronicles.com. Immortality or freedom? Which would you choose?
All right, well, the next thing I wanted to take a look at is courtesy of thestar.com.my. A tree is supposedly spraying out holy water. Thousands of people from as far as Johor and Malacca have been flocking to see two trees in Penang, which are said to be spraying holy water for the past week. Witnesses said they felt showers and occasional droplets from the tree, a 12-meter Pitai tree, and an 18-meter wild tree in Taman Ria Jaya in Sagai Petani. Researchers have different opinions on the reasons for the showers. Former University Kabansang Malaysia lecturer professor Dr. Zaidi Mat Isa said the showers from the trees could be water discharge or urine from cicadas during mating season. But it's difficult to imagine how these little insects can retain so much water, said the professor, who has been conducting research on cicadas for over 10 years. Abdul Ghani, who owns the 35-year-old Pitai tree, said he first felt the showers last Saturday about 4 p.m. when he was walking past the tree which is next to his poultry shed. Nora Yadi, who's a housewife, said she did not stop anyone from collecting the water, noting that some believed it was a blessing to wipe their bodies and face with the holy water. She said some individuals were even selling the water. The State Islamic Religious Department had put up a notice warning Muslims from worshiping the tree, noting that offenders could face a fine or even 2 years in jail. In the region, some individuals have even built an altar under the wild tree. They have lighted joss sticks and placed offerings including coffee, milk, tablets, and thosai with dal curry. The 25-year-old tree, located at an open field behind the Pasar Singah Selalu SP Market, had some pieces of holy cloth tied to its branches and bore some dried red marks which resembled blood stains. Interesting, man. You can go and take a look at this and take a look at the trees and the people underneath it and the, you know, the buckets that they have set up to collect the water to sell it. It's just, it's fascinating for me to know that people are collecting this and washing their bodies with it and selling it for money. And that's the funny part. It's yet said to be a religious thing, yet they're selling it for money. If it was a religious thing, don't you think that you would just give it away rather than selling it? I don't know. To me, it doesn't make any sense that you would sell this for money. I would think that, you know, being a holy thing, you would just give it away. But either way, it was really quite odd. The next thing I wanted to take a look at is courtesy of physorg.com, and it's a time travel experiment demonstrates how to avoid the grandfather paradox. Now, this is a good-sized article. I'm not going to read it all. The graph that's on this page shows that as the accuracy of the quantum gun increases from 0 to 180 degrees, it is more likely to flip a qubit's state. The probability of successful self-consistent teleportation decreases. Among the many intriguing concepts in Einstein's relativity theories is the idea of closed time-like curves, or CTCs, which are paths in space-time that return to their starting points. As such, CTCs offer the possibility of traveling back in time. But as many science fiction films have addressed, time travel is full of potential paradoxes. Perhaps the most notable of these is the grandfather paradox, in which a time traveler goes back in time and kills her grandfather, preventing her own birth. In a new study, a team of researchers has proposed a new theory of CTCs that can resolve the grandfather paradox, and they also perform an experiment showing how such a scheme works. The researchers, led by Seth Lloyd from MIT, along with scientists from the Scuola Normale Superiore in Pisa, Italy, along with the Tokyo Institute and the University of Toronto, have published their study in a recent issue of the Physical Review Letters. In the new theory, CTCs are required to behave like ideal quantum channels of the sort involved in teleportation. In this theory, self-consistent CTCs are post-selected and are called PCTCs. As the scientists explain, the theory differs from the widely accepted quantum theory of CTCs, in which a time traveler maintains self-consistency by traveling back into a different past than the one he or she remembers. Although post-selecting CTCs may seem complicated, it can actually be investigated experimentally in laboratory simulations. By sending a living qubit a few billionths of a second back in time to try and kill its former self, the scientists showed that only photons that don't kill themselves can make the journey. They went in and they took a single photon, one which represents the forwarding traveling qubit and one which represents the backward traveling qubit. The backward traveling qubit then teleported through a quantum channel, and only if the CTC ends by projecting the two entangled qubits into the same state. After the qubits are entangled, their states are measured by two probe qubits, and then a quantum gun is fired at the forward traveling qubit, which, depending on the gun's angle, may or may not rotate the qubit's polarization. The qubit's state are measured again to find out if the gun has flipped the forwarding traveling qubit's polarization or not. If both qubits are in the same state, then the gun has not flipped the polarization and the photon survives. If the qubit's state are not equal, then the photon was killed by itself. The experiment results show that the qubit's state were almost always equal, showing that a qubit cannot kill its former self, which basically means that if they were to do this with a human being, then a human being, if going back in time, would be completely and utterly unable to kill itself or its grandfather. It is possible to travel back in time and not have the sort of paradox that physics is saying you would have if you were to do so. But either way, I know it's a little bit complicated. I know some of that went right over my head, probably went over some of y'all's heads too. There is quite a bit more to this article there. I want you guys to go and take a look at it and let me know what you think. Let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of livescience.com. Buried soldiers may be victims of ancient chemical weapons. The skeleton of a Persian soldier found in the siege tunnels of Dura, the man may have been choked on toxic fumes from a fire he himself started. The man's armor is pulled up around his chest, and that's what you'll see in this picture. Archaeologists suspect he was trying to pull it off as he died. Almost 2,000 years ago, 19 Roman soldiers rushed into a cramped underground tunnel prepared to defend the Roman-held Syrian city of Dura Europos. from an army of Persians digging to undermine the city's mud brick walls. But instead of Persian soldiers, the Romans met with a wall of noxious black smoke that turned to acid in their lungs. Their crystal pommeled swords were no match for this weapon. The Romans choked and died in just moments, many with their last pay of coins still slung in purses on their belts. And nearby, a Persian soldier, perhaps the one who started the toxic underground fire, suffered his own death throes, grasping desperately at his chainmail skirt as he choked. Those 20 men who died in AD 256 may be the first victims of chemical warfare to leave any archaeological evidence of their passing, according to a new investigation. The case has very little physical evidence left behind beyond drawings and archaeological excavation notes from the 1930s. But a new analysis of those materials published in January in the American Journal of Archaeology finds that the soldiers likely did not die by the sword as the original excavator believed. Instead, they were gassed. Now, there's quite a bit more of this from, you know, what's going on and what happened to these guys and how they died, the horrors of war, the fumes of hell from what they're saying, and where there's smoke, there's fire. But there's a lot more to it there. I just found it to be really fascinating that these guys died of some kind of chemical warfare. Now, was it something that was planned? Because I would think that chemical warfare would be something that would be thought of and premeditated in ways, and this doesn't seem to be the case. Maybe they were just trying to smoke them out, and in turn, it killed them all. Now, there's, like I said, quite a bit more here to it. I want you guys to go and take a look at it and let me know what you think. Now, the next thing that I wanted to take a look at was a video from YouTube.com. It was a UFO that was filmed in Devon on March 5th of 2011. It almost seems a little too good to be true, but maybe not. Is it true? I don't know. You'll have to go and take a look at it for yourself. What you're basically going to see is a UFO hovering in a field. You can actually see the dog isn't fake, but you'll see this open field with a hill off to the left with trees all the way around. You'll see this UFO kind of come out of the woods a little bit. It will hover over in behind some more trees before, you know, the person zooms in. You can actually see it sitting there. Is it real? I don't know, but it does look pretty good if somebody did fake it. It looks pretty good behind the trees there, and then it zips off upwards really fast. That's all there is to it, and you'll see a dog come running off to the left from the right. Is it a fake UFO? It doesn't really look too fake. I mean, when the person zooms in and on it, it looks fairly real. But why would it be where it is? I mean, it almost seems a little too good to be true, a little too good of footage. I don't know. I want you guys to go and take a look at the video of a UFO filmed in Devon and let me know what you think. If you have some kind of a weird, strange, quirky talent, Ripley's Believe It or Not is looking for you. Again, is looking for the cream of the wacky crop to show off their bizarre skills on videos that will be voted on by visitors to the company's Believe It or Not auditorium in Manhattan. You can go to ripleysnewyork.com/index.cfm. I'll provide a link up to it so you can go there and check it out. Basically, they're going to have the public voting on who has the best strange talent. A panel of judges picks the winner from the five finalists. Will unveil them this summer alongside veteran fire eaters and sword swallowers. The winner could also take home a $1,000 prize. It's not enough to be a bearded lady or a two-headed man. The judges want a skill to go along with the unusual physique. Guidelines say that contestants must exhibit safe talents, but that term encompasses a broad range of stunts. The company has accepted people who have hammered spikes into their noses and dangled weights into their eyelids with fish hooks on previous talent searches. So in other words, if you have a really strange talent, you can go and watch about 8 minutes of some of the strange talents people have, you know, sword swallowing, that kind of thing. But it's a strange, strange world that we live in, some of the things that people can do. But if you do have a strange talent, go here. Maybe you can become part of the Ripley's Believe It or Not world. All right, guys and gals, I hate to say that for you free people, this is the last article of the show. And it's an interesting one. Some people might be immune to the zombie pandemic. ZRS researcher Tinley Albright recently put forth a bold theory about human-to-zombie immunity. She argues that a certain protected class of people will likely show little or no transformational effects from being exposed to otherwise toxic zombie contamination. Tinley points to the groundbreaking finding that roughly 1% of the global population is incapable of contracting the HIV virus, simply because of a genetic mutation. These mutated human cells have a slightly different structure than most, preventing the invading HIV cells from finding a suitable spot to attach themselves. The uncovered immunity in HIV and similar findings in leukemia and other cancers has had a profound implication on the way we look at the disease and the future evolution of treatment strategies. Some experts go so far as to suggest that every ailment there is someone who is immune. We just haven't tracked them all down yet. By that logic, Tinley asserts that not only is a small percentage of the population probably incapable of becoming a zombie, but those people may also hold the key to developing a working vaccine that could help prevent new zombie infections from spreading. Ultimately, a zombie will still tear you from limb to limb and leave you to die while it feasts on your internal organs with its friends. Not much your immunity can do to help you out of that mess. That is true. But it is fascinating to know. Now, I didn't know that 1% of the global population, which is roughly somewhere in the area of about 600,000 people, are immune to contracting the HIV virus. And it is true. Now, I know a lot of you are out there saying, come on, TJ, the zombie apocalypse is never going to happen. Well, it might. You never know. It could be some kind of a weird disease or virus that gets spread that actually could turn people into some kind of crazy zombie. But, I mean, you never know. It is possible. Everything is always possible. You just have to wait to see if it's ever going to happen. But to know that some people might be immune to it is simply just fascinating. Well, guys and gals, boys and girls, for those of you who are listening to the free show, I really do appreciate you coming out and taking a listen to it. And since it is the end of the show, let's go ahead and bury the formalities and get them in the dirt and out of the way. If you want to support this show as much as you can and you want more of the 13 Skulls, go sign up at premium.the13skulls.com. Again, it's only $5 a month and you'll get 4 episodes a month, 2 extended versions of the regular free show, and 2 extended shows. That's only $5 a month for upwards of 8 hours of content, so go sign up. If you have an experience or feedback to share, email me at the13skulls@gmail.com or info@the13skulls.com. Or if you'd rather call in and tell me your feedback, good or bad, it's 206-338-2205 or 817-986-0019. If you like the music in the show, some of it will be courtesy of the IOTA PromoNet at www.iotaalliance.com, or some of it might be provided by Mevio's Music Alley. Go check them out at music.mevio.com. The sound effects that have been, are being, will be used in the show courtesy of the Free Sound Project at www.freesound.org. If you have a podcast or book or show or anything else you want to swap promos or have yours played in the show, just email me and let me know. If you want a button or a magnet, email me with your name and address and I'll ship one out to you ASAP. I do have to order some more, so I'm down to my last few. Just let me know. I'll get it out to you as soon as I can. I will post up links to everything you hear about in the show notes for this episode. For those of you who are listening to the premium episode, stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute. We got a lot of really good stuff coming to you. We're going to be taking a look at chupacabras, or hyper-evolved vampire attacks on the rise in Mexico, the rat robot, an update on the Kali cybernetic organism, and Charlie Sheen is facing a warlock curse, which is just really quite hilarious to me, and a volcanic fissure opens up in Hawaii. So you guys stay put. We'll be back in just a minute. So you guys and gals, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening to the free show, I hope you have a great day, night, week, weekend, whatever it is that you're listening to this, and I'll talk to you guys again on another day.
Break! confident in anything that I do. For me, it's always been in a mess. And I ran away from myself when I needed me. No, so I'll bring it out and bring it out.